Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here. You can reach out to us, provide us feedback, positive, negative, otherwise, whatever kind of response you've got to what we're doing here every three times a day here on WKAR Current State. It's Current State at WKAR.org. Later in the hour, NPR's Don Gagne, who's an MSU alum, as many of you probably know, and he covers the White House now for NPR. He's a WKAR alumnus, as I understand it. But Don Gagne visits us. He's here for graduation this week. Also, we'll explore the value of arts and physical education in the Lansing School District, of course, that is undergoing a significant change. And we're going to talk with some professional educators here at Michigan State about just the cost that is paid there and just how they expect that to play out. But first, Michigan legislators and numerous stakeholders around the state continue to spar over whether to fund an expansion of Medicaid here in Michigan. Supporters of expansion, which would happen, by the way, as part of the Federal Affordable Care Act, claim it's fair to extend coverage to more low-income residents and that it would be good for the economy. Opponents say they fear the future costs of the move, and some resist anything connected with Obamacare. To revisit the case for and against expanding Medicaid here in Michigan, we're joined by two special guests. Republican State Senator Rick Jones represents Eaton County. And you're in the 23rd or 24th?
I can 24th never keep
going. District. 24th. Okay, 24th Senate District, including Eaton County. And he opposes funding and expansion. Robin Reynolds supports it. Robin is the executive director of the Ingham Health Plan. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Before we get further into Medicaid expansion, Robin Reynolds, I'm hoping you'll bear with me for just a minute or so Senator Rick Jones can update us on a couple of things. The legislature is in the middle of a very busy session. The Senate will be getting two bills apparently designed to alter the behavior of Michigan welfare recipients. Those bills would stop cash assistance if welfare recipients' kids miss too much school or if an adult tests positive for drug use. Are you familiar enough with these measures to know whether you're likely to support them?
Absolutely, I will support them. It's very important for children to stay in school. If they don't, they won't succeed in life, and they will be a further drain on our economy. I personally have seen children who are food deprived because their parents use their welfare money for drugs and alcohol. And so I fully support drug testing welfare recipients who show signs of drug abuse.
You'll also see a measure that would start levying sales taxes on internet purchases. This would be aimed at online retailers with a physical presence here in Michigan or with an affiliated company here in Michigan. Do you like this idea?
Well, I think it's a fairness issue. A brick-and-mortar store, they have to collect the sales tax. The online don't have to collect it. And although everybody that buys something online does owe that money, you're supposed to fill out a form at the end of the year on your Michigan income tax and pay that 6%, I believe very few do it. So we're talking about a fairness issue, and I'm ready to look at the topic. I really think we need help, though, from the federal government, because there'll be many sales coming in from California that nobody will have any power over.
Let's segue into Medicaid expansion here then. Rick Jones, the state house's proposed budget does not include funding for Medicaid expansion. The issue is still being discussed in the Senate. Does it seem to you the Senate will follow suit and not include funding for Medicaid? Is that what you would expect?
Yes, I think the current proposal does not have support of the senators. I think there's problems with simply giving away things for free, and a great many senators are calling for reforms first. There's an old expression, skin in the game, and I think people would like the users, the customers, to have a little skin in the game. In other words, if you're going to accept this money and go get treatment, perhaps there should be co-pays. Perhaps there should be programs mandating that you stop smoking, that you lose weight if you're extremely obese. Why should the taxpayers pay for your bad behavior?
Let's bring Robin Reynolds into the fold now after we revisit just a couple of key facts in this debate. The Affordable Care Act calls for universal health care coverage. One part of that involves expanding Medicaid. The federal government is offering to cover the costs of that expansion through 2016, which the governor and others say could reduce Michigan's general fund spending on Medicaid by over $200 million a year. After 2016, Michigan would gradually begin to cover some of those costs. In the process, anywhere from $250,000 to over 300,000 low-income people in the state would begin to receive health care coverage. Robin Reynolds, why do you support Medicaid expansion?
I support Medicaid expansion because it's the right thing to do. We have not covered low-income individuals adequately with health benefits. Medicaid in the state and throughout the nation is a very categorical program where if you're just poor, you don't get medical benefits. It's if you're disabled, yes. If you're a child, yes, which are all great programs, but I think we need to expand it to the people who are the neediest, and also many people included in that are actually working. They just have low-income jobs and don't have health insurance.
Okay, and that's the lion's share of why you support this, is fairness.
Fairness, and I think it's good for the economy. I think it is good in the long run. We'll save money because people will get health care earlier, and it will prevent chronic disease in the future. It will allow them to have a medical home rather than using the emergency room or higher levels of care. It'll keep people out of the hospital. I think it's a great prevention tool as well.
Senator Rick Jones, why do you oppose Medicaid expansion?
Well, I oppose the current proposal. Many of the folks on this this designation can already get Medicaid. With the new changes in the law, many under the age of 26 will be able to get insurance coverage from their parents. And what's really important, a lot of these folks fall above the 100% federal poverty level. Now, they will be able to go down the exchange and get federally subsidized insurance. The Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, whatever the phrase is you want to call it, many of these folks will already be able to get that coverage. So it makes no sense for us to spend $300 million that we don't have on something that the feds are already providing. Now, there will be some perhaps 200,000 people that don't fall into some of these categories. Those are usually
that could be over 300,000. I've read various estimates.
I'm talking about the ones that aren't eligible to purchase. So you are, if you're above this 100% poverty level, you're going to be able to go on the exchange and purchase your insurance,
right,
federally subsidized. So those folks already will be able to get coverage. Those are being included in this number. They should not be. Okay, the ones that don't fall into this category are going to be mainly the singles or young couples. And as a state, we can provide a program for them at much less cost than the $300 million we're projected to have to come up with. In fact, we have many counties currently doing health programs, and I think the state could follow that type of program.
Robin Reynolds, do you agree with Senator Jones' arithmetic here?
I know that in my plan, there are 12,000 people, and approximately 70% of those would be under 100% of poverty. And also across the state, in the county health plans, we have about 150,000 people covered, and about 120,000 of those would be eligible for Medicaid under the new rules. But many of the people we serve are actually under 100% of poverty. So they wouldn't be eligible for exchange services. The other issue is we're waiting to see. Michigan doesn't have an exchange, but the federal exchange will cover people above 100%, but we don't know what those benefits will be yet. We don't know that they will be affordable for individuals. Even with the subsidy, there are some fears that they won't be affordable for some individuals. So that's kind of a wait and see what insurance companies put out on the exchange. And again, there is a subsidy, so that does work for part of the population, but my concern is for the people under 100% of poverty, because they are families, they're individuals, these are people who make $15,000 a year or less, and we serve, with one of our programs, people that make $35,000 a year or less, and those are typically males who don't qualify for anything else. 35% of poverty or less, and you're expected to pay for some type of health insurance. It just can't be done.
Can you respond to that, Senator Jones? I mean,
you know, whenever something is free, it's abused. And I can tell you, as a former jail administrator, we had medical help for all the inmates. And when it was free, they all lined up to see the nurse in the morning and talked about their aches and pains. But when it was $5, simply $5, a lot of them would rather spend it on candy bars than go down and see the nurse. So I think the phrase that's being used around Lansing is true. People need to have a little skin in the game, a little copay, perhaps a mandate that you must stop smoking, must lose weight and stop being obese, and expecting the taxpayers to simply pick up all of your medical costs.
What do you make of that, Robin?
Well, I would say that there's a lot of people obese. There's a lot of smokers in Michigan, and we're paying for that. I mean, we pay for employer-based health insurance through the services we buy. So those people, like myself, has a health benefit that you're paying for that through services that you purchase. And we're not making them quit. We're encouraging them to quit smoking. We're encouraging them to quit drinking. We're encouraging them to lose weight. But they, too, are costing me money because I have to pay for services. My insurance increases. So we're all paying for the unhealthy people. And it's not just poor people that are in that situation. We're all paying for that.
Rick Jones, is there a single change in this Medicaid expansion framework that would get you to support it? Is there any of the recommendations that you've just made here in the last couple of
minutes?
There would
have to be major reforms put on the table.
Copays. Copays alone would not do it?
And drug testing. You know, everybody that goes out to get a job gets drug tested. Even the directors who work for the governor of the state of Michigan get drug tested. I was challenged by a guy who wrote into the local paper, I demand that the senators go out and get drug tested. I went out and paid my $38 and got tested like everybody else. There's no reason why the folks that accept this welfare should not be drug tested. Why are we paying for people to be addicted?
Clearly, Robin Reynolds, there's deep concern from Senator Jones and others about longer-term costs as well. Why does that not concern you?
Well, I think the governor has a good plan for longer-term costs, to put money away to help to subsidize some of those longer-term costs, and with the money that will be coming in from the federal government. So some of that is mitigated. Sure, it bothers me. I'm a taxpayer. I don't like to see a deficit either, but I also know that there are things we can do, such as tax loopholes, higher taxes on millionaires, look at the entire federal budget. And I mean, we're sending money to other countries for things that we need to take care of people in our own country. I would also like to comment about the the drug testing. And I don't think everybody's drug tested who are people who are employed. It's not mandatory that they're drug tested. And if they are drug tested, they need to be able to have substance abuse treatment. We do not fund substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment like we should in this country. Part of this Affordable Care Act and this money that will come in from the federal government and Medicaid expansion will cover substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment. And that's who we see in the emergency room. People don't wake up and go, I think I'm going to use drugs today. They are addicted. They have a medical issue. It's not a moral issue. It is a medical issue. And if we're going to do drug testing, then we need to offer some. We need to offer care for these individuals that are addicted to alcohol or other drugs.
Rick Jones, should Michigan invest more in drug abuse treatment, mental health treatment?
Absolutely, I support more mental health treatment, and I support putting people that are addicted into rehab programs. If you're going to take welfare, then you need to be in rehab. But I want to emphasize, that's not the only problem. The problem are there are children at home who are hungry. I have personally seen this. My daughter takes in foster children who have been abused because their parents are addicted to methamphetamine or cocaine or some product out there, and they're not feeding those kids. That's why we have to have all the in-school feeding programs so children aren't starving and so they can learn. So this is more than just dealing with the adults. It's making sure our children in Michigan are safe.
Senator, you've not taken the party line, if you will, at least once recently when you advocated reversal of the new pension tax. You claimed that many of your constituents voiced opposition to it. You pointed out that a lot of retired people had spent years planning their retirements, and it wasn't fair to disrupt it like that. I take it, has there been less feedback from the district on Medicaid expansion? What are you hearing from your constituents on Medicaid expansion?
Honestly, very little. I've had some calls, yes, but it's not been overwhelming. And I have had a lot of negative calls against it. Don't sign up for Obamacare. That's what a lot of people think this is simply an expansion of Obamacare. I listen to my district, I listen to my constituents, and I try to make a very careful call. And before we expand, the people that receive this must have some skin in the game.
Robin Reynolds, how would the operations of the Ingham Health Plan change if we were to move forward on Medicaid expansion?
Again, probably 70% of our members would be eligible for Medicaid. So the Ingham Health Plan, their role will certainly change. And we may be changing to offer some type of subsidy to people who can't afford what's on the exchange. Many of the health plans will go away. And that is because the funding that is attached to county health plans will go away, whether we expand Medicaid or not. And that's one of
right.
the problems.
The Affordable Care Act still moves forward.
Yes.
But, okay.
And the money that has previously supported the health plans does go away. So we're not here as a safety net anymore to cover the people under 100% of poverty. So somebody needs to be.
Okay. Well, we will keep our eyes on this issue at the state capitol. It's in the hands of the Senate here now. We want to thank both of our guests here for coming in today to bat around a very important topic. Republican State Senator Rick Jones represents the 24th Senate District, including Eaton County, and Robin Reynolds is Executive Director of the Ingham Health Plan. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. The senseless tragedies that took place last year at a Colorado movie theater and at a Connecticut elementary school brought renewed focus to the national debate over gun control. It's a thorny issue that impacts everything from constitutional rights to mental health care. Every year, the Ingham County Sheriff's Department invites members of the media to take part in a short hands-on lesson in firearm safety. The program goes beyond simply teaching reporters how to fire a weapon, and as Current State's Kevin Lavery reports, it also provides a glimpse into the emotions faced by those who carry in the name of the law.
I didn't grow up around guns. It just wasn't a part of my family culture. I made it from birth through my senior year, never picking up anything stronger than a squirt pistol. After high school, I joined the Navy to become a journalist. On my last hitch in Japan, I joined the base auxiliary security force, which essentially meant that I was an overnight road patrolman. A few nights a month, I'd ride in the cruiser, escorting inebriated sailors back to their ships. But what I remember the most was the days when we'd go to the firing range. That's where I first began to learn what real police officers are thinking and feeling whenever they squeeze the trigger. Fast forward 20 years. I haven't fired a gun since. But now I'm listening as Ingham County Deputy Sheriff James Every brings it all back for me.
This is a 40 caliber 226 six-hour pistol. The big thing about this gun here is that there's no safety on this gun. The safety on this gun is our finger. Okay, our finger's outside the trigger guard, up on the side of the rail here, until we're ready to shoot.
I don the required glasses and earplugs. Every signals us to the mark.
Step into your bay when you're ready.
I am ready, but I'm nervous. I can see my old instructor, a Marine gunnery sergeant, telling me in less than polite terms about always pointing my weapon downrange. I can hear him repeat a sobering command. Never let the muzzle of your gun cover anything that you're not willing to destroy, even a paper target. Four of us step up to the line. It's go time.
10 rounds on the X at your leisure, okay? The line is hot. Go ahead.
Every recoil is a palm-sized explosion. The jolt surprises me every time. The brass shells bounce off my arms and chest. I can't see the bullseye as clearly as I could in my sailor days. 10 rounds and it's over. The target glides back to me. Most of the shots are left of center, with a couple of stray hits high and low. I'm floored to see two in the bullseye adorned with an X. Not the best score, but not the worst either. What's more interesting to me is the looks on the faces of my fellow reporters. The first-timers are easy to spot. Deputy James Every says the emotional state of the participants is a big part of this exercise.
We see a lot of tension, anxiety, a lot of buildup of fear, what's going to happen here, I'm not sure, the unknown. So that's actually what we want the public to be aware of. Hey, there is a lot of fear and panic that could happen right here in a shootout situation that involves firearms. So I guess it's the media's job to help get people the news out there to help them know it is going to be stressful. It is going to be a life-changing event that will happen.
A big enough life-changer, it's hoped, to help journalists who cover violent crime perhaps deliver the news with more sensitivity. Before leaving the range with my souvenir target, I asked Ingham County Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth about the rash of gun violence that occurred in America over the last year and what he thinks meaningful gun control legislation should include.
Well, the thing that we need to do as it relates to gun control, we don't have to worry about John Q. Citizen. They're not going to do something stupid. The people we have to worry about are the people that have mental problems. And right now, it's an exclusion if you've been deemed mentally ill. You cannot get a gun permit if that's the case. The trouble is there's no way for us to determine that. There's no database that we can query. You can ask them, but of course they're not going to tell you they're mentally ill. So the person, we issue a permit to them and they go out and do something stupid, then we look like idiots. But the problem is there's got to be some type of a database, in my opinion, that we can include in our background check to make that an exclusion. It doesn't exist today.
Is that happening in dialogue about legislation, state or federal, that you're aware of?
Both. We've had that discussion at the state level, recently met with Senator Levin at the national level and had that very discussion. So it's out there. They're aware of it.
Hopefully it'll come to fruition.
Let's hope.
For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery.
Stay with us. More Current State after the news. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're with us. I'm Mark Bayshore. We've learned today that Detroit Schools Emergency Manager Roy Roberts is stepping down after 2 years. Roy Roberts at the helm of the Detroit Public Schools DPS for a couple of years, and he apparently will be stepping down. Recently, the Lansing School District announced that it will cut as many as 87 teachers in an effort to address the district's budget deficit. Many of the teachers expected to be laid off are certified to teach art, music, and physical education to elementary school students. The district says it's not eliminating its arts and physical ed programs, but redesigning them using existing teachers and outside programming as a substitute. But studies have shown that arts and physical education are more than just extras. These studies suggest they belong among the group of core subjects like math, science, history, and language arts. Here with us to discuss the role of arts and physical education in shaping our youth, Mitch Robinson, an MSU associate professor in the School of Music and chair of the Music Education Department. Also, Karen Pfeiffer, an MSU associate professor of kinesiology, who studies physical activity in children and adolescents. Both of them recently had essays in the Lansing State Journal about the school district cuts and are here to share more. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Many people, Mitch, seem to think that completely cutting arts education happens so often that it's almost become a cliche. The first to go are always music and art. But how often does it really happen on the scale that it's happening in Lansing?
Well, the cuts to arts programs on this scale are actually fairly rare. We do see a widespread kind of cutting of art and phys ed and music programs, but that usually happens as a result of more across-the-board types of cuts. Let me give you one example. In 1978, the Niagara Falls, New York School District cut all of their elementary art and music programs. We're 35 years later, they're back to about 50% enrollment. So a cut of an elementary music program totally, or art or phys ed, is a pretty devastating and permanent solution to a temporary budget problem.
And Karen, have you heard of other large school districts cutting physical education?
We haven't heard about that as often. We've heard certainly of cutting back, but we haven't really heard about cutting out as much lately, particularly given recent statistics with the obesity epidemic and with the First Lady's Let's Move movement now in place. It's been a lot more rare to actually hear of programs being completely cut.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, the district says it's not eliminating its arts and physical education programming, but redesigning them using existing teachers and outside programming as a substitute. Is that an important detail here?
It's an important interpretation. I'm just not sure how you teach these subjects without teachers. I think, you know, one of the things that I think we do need to know from the district is what exactly their plan is to be innovative about providing these programs. I think it's a little bit of semantic ballet. It's one thing to say that we're not cutting programs, but when you are eliminating teaching positions, that's in fact what you're doing. One of the things that the district has kind of hinted at is bringing in arts providers from the community, but you know, we have a pretty good coalition of those arts providers right now who are not in agreement with working with the district in that way. So the district really hasn't been very transparent about what their plan is, other than that they're going to overload a bunch of their elementary teachers who are already overloaded and have them teach those subjects.
Make the case here, Karen Pfeiffer, for the importance of physical education. Why should it? Do you feel it belongs amongst the core subjects that need to be taught in elementary school?
Absolutely, 100%. Physical education is tied to health. Number one, it's tied to basic movements and patterns and bone loading and muscle strength and cardiovascular fitness that are tied to what's going to happen to you later in life and your quality of life. So from that standpoint, it's completely linked to health outcomes down the road. But from an academic standpoint, there's evidence showing that physical education is linked to better academic performance in the form of grades, in the form of on-task behavior in the classroom, things like that. So if you take that away, you're taking away an opportunity to actually help improve the academic subjects, the core subjects that you're keeping and focusing on in the first place.
Okay. Mitch Robinson, what about arts?
Well, I think the arts are part of how children learn. There's an awful lot of evidence that that kids learn, young children especially, in a holistic way. They don't learn in this compartmentalized, siloed way that schools are often organized. So taking out an entire way for children to understand the world just is not educative. It's a pretty draconian kind of measure.
In 2013, Mitch Robinson, what kinds of things get taught in an elementary level music class? Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Well, you know, there's a fair amount of overlap with what Karen is talking about. There's a lot of emphasis on movement with young children for them to understand how their bodies work in space, elements of flow, elements of weight, elements of displacement,
tension. In terms of making music, though?
Absolutely, using their bodies to make music. For young children, their natural instrument is their voice and their body. So kids are learning how, through music classes and movement classes, how to use their bodies and how to understand senses and perception. And then, of course, as they get older and have more musical readiness skills, we also introduce them to instruments and to singing in choruses. So there are a lot of music activities and a solid curriculum. And the Lansing Schools has had a really fine music program. So to see it get removed like this is very painful.
What makes a Karen Pfeiffer, what makes a really good physical education teacher? What are the features or the traits that really make somebody stand out?
Sure. The top level teachers that I've seen do an excellent job at keeping children active while they're teaching the skills. They need to absolutely teach the fundamental movement patterns, skipping, throwing, leaping, striking, all of the fundamental motor skills. They need to do that at the same time balancing, keeping the children active while they're there. They need to expose them to a variety of activities so that down the road, these children have opportunities to participate in a lot of different activities that might be out there. So traditional sports, but also some of the other kinds of activities you could consider lifetime type of physical activities. And the best teachers do this in a way that really creates a construct called physical competence, and it's their belief that they can do these movements compared to others, and it's fostering those types of beliefs and skills early on that set people up for a lifetime of being able to move appropriately.
I'm wondering if this programming isn't really a casualty of the emphasis on STEM. Everybody knows, so many people have become aware of this phrase STEM, science, technology, electronics, and math.
Engineering,
I'm sorry. Yep. In recent years, alluding to the brain drain, alluding to competition with other nations, doesn't that set arts and physical education up as just, I mean, arts and physical education is not a STEM, it's not regarded as STEM subjects. I'm wondering if this isn't your battle there.
I mean, I think one of the big ironies is that both in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act reauthorization and in the Common Core, the arts were included as a core subject. So there's a little bit, again, of semantic ballet about this. The arts are in the core. They have been for quite a long time. The STEM thing is, I think, a relatively recent just acronym that's thrown around. The other acronym that, of course, the arts people like a lot more is STEAM, which includes the arts in the core.
I had not heard that.
Yeah. Well, we like that a lot.
Very good. There is apparently a report that I believe one or both of you alluded to in your state journal op-ed pieces about a report from the National Center for Education Statistics that showed that levels of arts education, Mitch Robinson, was tied to socioeconomic status. Did you include that in your op-ed? Do you know about that?
Well, I think, you know, just in terms of educational attainment in general, most of the evidence, almost all of the evidence, points to differences among children being tied more tightly to socioeconomic status than to schools or teachers or, the whole income inequity issue is really at the core of what people are talking about in the problems in education. So largely problems in education are problems in society. And, you know, the schools and recently the teachers are kind of convenient scapegoats for a lot of that. But, you know, what we need – and this situation actually in Lansing is not helping that at all. I mean, we're taking something away from kids that they have a right to, they have access to in arts education, music education, physical education, and media that their peers in surrounding school districts have. And that's a socioeconomic status issue as well. Arne Duncan, no less than the Secretary of Education, calls any kinds of trims or cuts to arts education a civil rights issue in urban schools.
Are there examples of ways to do this better?
Well, we don't have to look very far. The Waverly Schools just approved a contract that was had a very similar budget outlook, and they did it in a way that did not significantly impact one program over another. They made cost center cuts. The teachers made substantial givebacks on their health insurance premiums. They froze wages for 3 years. But that's an example of a school district, leadership, union, and teachers working together to maintain programs for kids.
Okay. Mitch Robinson is an associate professor in MSU's School of Music and chair of the Music Education Department. Karen Pfeiffer is an associate professor of kinesiology here at MSU who studies physical activity in children and adolescents. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And right now would seem like a good time for another public poetry announcement.
Passing Through Albuquerque by John Balaban. At dusk by the irrigation ditch gurgling past backyards near the highway, locusts raise a maze of calls in cottonwoods. A Spanish girl in a white party dress strolls the levee by the muddy water where her small sister plunks in stones. Beyond a low adobe wall and a wrecked car, men are pitching horseshoes in a dusty lot. Someone shouts as he clangs in a ringer. Big winds buffet in ahead of a storm, rocking the immense trees and whipping up clouds of dust, wild leaves, and cotton wool. In the moment when the locusts pause and the girl presses her up-fluttering dress to her bony knees, you can hear a banjo, guitar, and fiddle playing the Mississippi Sawyer inside a shack. Moments like that, you can love this country. Passing Through Albuquerque by John Balaban. I'm David Clausen, and this public poetry announcement has been brought to you by Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities.
Its current state, I'm Mark Bayshore. The MSU College of Communication Arts and Sciences will honor NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne this week with the 2013 WKAR Public Media Master Award. Gagne earned 2 degrees from MSU on his way to a remarkable career in radio. Current state Scott Pohl spoke with Don Gagne this week about the award and about his work at NPR.
I got a call several weeks ago from Gary Reed, who, of course, is WKAR's general manager. I know Gary as my first ever radio professor when I was a student at Michigan State way back in the – exactly. So he taught me how to cut tape and how to set levels and how to follow the signal path. I don't know if anybody knows what that means anymore, but he taught me how to do it, and it's one of those important little skills you have as a radio reporter. And he and I have maintained a long and very dear friendship over the years. And he said they were creating this award and that it's named after WKAR and that it honors someone with a long career in public media, and I guess I qualify in that regard since my first public radio job was 1986. Used to volunteer at WKAR back when I was a student. And I'm just very, very, very flattered. What can I say?
Now, you're back on campus once in a while. What motivates you to come back to MSU?
I just love the place. I do. I mean, my first trip to MSU, I mean, I guess we're really going down memory lane here, aren't we? But my first trip to MSU was when my oldest sister was a student there in the 1960s, and she lived in Wonders Hall. And I remember going to lunch with her at Wonders Hall, and I'm, you know, 9 years old or something like that, or 8 years old. And there's Bubba Smith, who also lived in Wonders Hall, you know, eating lunch just a few feet away. And I just got hooked on the place very early on. Obviously, when it came time to choose a school, I wanted to pick a school that was right for me. And Michigan State had a great program, and I enrolled. And for all the fun I had visiting my sister when I was just a little kid, the school was everything I'd hoped for and more as a student. And I feel very grateful for what the school meant to me, what the professors I had did for me, how it was able to launch me on what has been an endlessly fascinating career. I wake up in the morning anxious to go to work every day because it's a new adventure. And I trace all of that back to my years at Michigan State. And hey, it's also springtime on the most beautiful campus in America. So I'm really happy to come back for that reason, too.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you this week, Don. I want to talk a little bit about your work at the White House. That's what you're primarily known for to NPR listeners, I think it's safe to say. Primarily the White House correspondent during the George W. Bush presidency. I wanted to ask you, what's the best part of the White House beat, and what's the worst part about covering the White House?
The joke is that being White House correspondent for any news organization is a great job to have had, because it's great to look back on your years at the White House. I mean, while you're doing it, it's very grueling, and the days are long, and your day really starts as soon as you wake up in the morning and start listening to the radio and seeing what other reporters who cover the beat for, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and other newspapers have in the paper. And it doesn't really end until you lay your head down on the pillow to go to sleep, because you just always feel like you have to be plugged in. So it's challenging. A lot of deadlines. Again, that's not necessarily bad, but it's a great deal of work. It just is. And I think people both understand that and appreciate it. The best part of it kind of grows out of the same thing. I mean, you are going to the White House every day, or going wherever the president goes every day. And as someone who grew up a news junkie and a political junkie like I did, you are always aware that you are a witness to history. Now, you're seeing, you know, one slice of it. You're seeing the view that you get from inside the White House press corps. But the president is such a, you know, a key figure in the world, and any American president, certainly. And during George W. Bush's time, you know, whatever your feelings about him and his presidency, it was a hugely consequential 8 years in American history. It is a privilege to be kind of up close and to be able to observe it from as closely as you can when you're in the White House press corps.
Don, your current title is National Political Correspondent, and last year we heard your reports on the road covering the 2012 election. What does that mean in a non-election year like 2013?
You know, it is very liberating, actually, to have this job. In some ways, I have the job that I had before I even moved to Washington when I was in Detroit, which means it was a job that was focused on talking to real people out in the world and getting their reaction to stories. And in Detroit, when I was NPR's Detroit Bureau, a lot of times that was people in union halls or on picket lines or at political rallies or whatever. These days, I'm kind of doing that again. I feel like it's my job to talk to America. And I do it now with the benefit of having been a White House correspondent for 10 years and having seen all that I was able to see doing that job. That also means people know me a little better when I walk up to them and introduce myself. But I'm still looking for a way to tell the stories that are the big political stories happening in the country, but I'm not doing it from inside a White House bubble anymore where your schedule is very controlled. It means I might be, as I was last week, at the opening of the George W. Bush Presidential Museum and Library down in Dallas, or I might find myself at an immigration rally somewhere out in the country, or I may find myself on the campus of, I can say it here, Ohio State University, watching the State of the Union address with young Republicans and talking to young Republicans about the state of their party and where they think the party needs to go. And on issue after issue after issue, my bosses let me fly someplace where that issue is playing out, get a rental car, go to the airport, pull out of the airport, and just decide which direction I'm going to point the car and which direction I'm going to drive. And a little bit of it's like a scavenger hunt. It's kind of like, which way do I go to find what I may be looking for here? But I always seem to find something, and it's great fun and very kind of very heartening to have a job where you just get to talk to people.
After all these years at NPR, Don, do you have the sort of clout with the network, or if nothing else, maybe seniority, where you get to have more say in your assignments?
I do. You get to do that less when you're covering the White House because, I mean, face it, when you're at the White House, every day there's a full schedule and the news and the schedule and the events kind of come at you like a fire hose. But I would say at least half of the stories I do are things that popped into my head. And I say, wouldn't this be interesting? Or how about I go here and do this? A lot of them are rooted in something that happened somewhere and I just need to go cover it. And it's not necessarily my call. But I do feel like I have a good bit of leeway in determining both my own schedule and where I go.
It's always fun to turn my radio on and hear you hosting one of the NPR shows. Do you like hosting?
It is a really fun change of pace now and then. I got to fill in for Scott Simon some weeks ago, and then I did weekend All Things Considered. The thing hosting does for you is you get to use very different muscles, and you get to do very different kinds of stories. When I filled in for Scott, I had the opportunity to dig out this 32-year-old interview I had done with Johnny Cash back in the early days of my career when I was working for a commercial country radio station and turn that into, an essay that I think spoke to people today. You get to do music interviews. You get to do book interviews that you don't necessarily get to do when you're covering national politics. So it's great fun, and I love my regular day job, but I do like being able to do that every now and then as a change of pace.
Well, Don Gagne, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today, and congratulations on your upcoming award from MSU.
It's my pleasure. It's fun to talk to you. We've been friends and colleagues for more years than either of us are going to admit here. So I look forward to seeing you and everybody on campus this weekend. It's going to be fun.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss how American teens understand and talk about race. Also, an update on the threat Asian carp pose to the Great Lakes. We'll also catch up with John Schneider, late of the Lansing State Journal. John's writing now for The Bridge, and he's busy blogging, and his son is becoming famous, so lots to talk about there. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer, thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry and Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.